Okay, we're going to get started with the next topic for discussion, which covers the communication requirements related to interim reviews. Under the current requirements in an interim review, an auditor should determine if any of the matters described by AU Section 380 as they relate to the interim financial information have been identified. If matters are identified, they should be communicated to the audit committee by the auditor or by management. In consideration of the importance shareholders place on interim financial statements, the board is considering whether these requirements should be enhanced, and if so, how. With that, our next discussion question is, are the current audit committee communication requirements for interim reviews effective? What additional communication requirements would be beneficial to audit committees? And it might help, I guess, tee up the question if anyone wants to share the types of communications they do see on an interim basis or that they share with clients on an interim basis. Liz?
Since nobody else wanted to say anything, we sort of do a mini version of year-end where we provide a letter going through significant estimates and quality of the application of the accounting principles. So it's maybe a quicker process, but we indicate if we had found any deficiencies during our quarterly review or any of our internal control work or interim work or anything like that. So our firm's policy is to have a formal discussion similar to that which you have at year end, but clearly only based upon a review process as opposed to an audit process, so that we bring things to the audit committee timely in the event that something needs to be changed, fixed, resolved prior to 12/31.
So based upon that, I'm gathering that some of the communications that were on that page we looked at before around significant judgments and estimates, I think probably feedback is coming out of your data. significant judgments and estimates, to the extent there's something important as part of the quarterly review, you'd say you'd discuss that with the audit committee as part of reviewing the interim results. And I gather also, would you be sharing with the committee whether or not you felt there were any material modifications that needed to be made to the interim financial information being filed with the SEC?
Absolutely. Depending upon which quarter it is, the amount of work that you're doing might vary. For example, the closer you get to year end, you might be doing some interim procedures during that quarter at the same time. So the amount of information you might have on hand to talk about is going to vary at the same time. But we would absolutely be talking about anything that we think would reflect on your end or needed to be changed in the queue or disclosures that needed to be improved, for example. And we may not say they must be improved in this quarter, but we might indicate that we would expect to see improvement in this disclosure next quarter to get you to a certain threshold or level by year end, those kinds of things. For accelerated filers, we might be talking about 404 and their identification of significant accounts. We might start to see growth in a particular account during the year, and we might indicate to them that they need to consider including that account in their significant accounts for examination under 404. So it's a wide variety of things that you would discuss, but we have a reporting section in our work papers where we would include that correspondence. But again, just like our last conversation, if you look at my work papers, it's going to look pretty boilerplate. But the discussions are not boilerplate. But the work papers would probably look that way.
Work papers would look compliant with the requirements. The discussions would be robust, you're saying. Thanks. Wayne, I thought your card was up. You thought about it and changed your mind? Or?
Well, it wasn't much to add beyond what Liz had mentioned. It's more of an updating process, much like the 10Q itself is an updating process in terms of disclosures. So anything that comes up in those particular areas that are based on, that we see based on a limited procedures that we perform, we bring to the audit committee's attention. But there are formal meetings set up to provide that mechanism for a dialogue.
Liz?
We also take that time as an opportunity to discuss what's coming, because at least lately there's been a lot of March 31 or June 30 effective dates and 9/30 effective dates, so we've sort of used that opportunity in the prior Q discussion to talk about things that are going to be happening next quarter and things that the audit committee needs to be paying attention to next quarter because they're going to be changing. So,
although the it's not fully contemplated in this question, but I thought I would just pose this question. There's the opportunity for auditors to issue written review reports as part of interim reviews. I tend to observe that I don't think that's happening very often. I was wondering if the auditors would be willing to comment if that observation was correct, that formal quarterly review reports were or were not being issued often, and if not, why you might think the committee, audit committees, might not want a review report if that's the case. Randy Fletchell?
Marty, I can answer the first part of the question. I haven't looked recently, but we did a few years back, and it's a very distinct minority of our SEC registrants that request that we issue a review report. The procedures are performed. I think it's just been one of those things that no one has really made a big deal of in the past. And so, I can remember when I go back years ago, we might have issued 100 out of more than 1,000 registrants, so it was pretty few.
Sam.
I think our experience is similar to Randy's. There's actually three buckets. There's the report that gets submitted with the 10Q. There's our times when we issue a report, but it only goes to the audit committee, and then there's times when we don't issue a report at all, just provide the company with clearance that we don't have anything that causes them to have to make some disclosure in their 10Q about the effect of our review, because, as you know, the review is assumed when you file the 10Q. I can't speak to why audit committees fall into any of those three buckets. It could be that the communication on an interim basis with the auditors is so effective that they don't think they need a report. It's somewhat said in jest, but I don't know the answer to the second question right now.
We don't have Lynn as, maybe we have a couple of audit committee members here. I don't know if they'd like to comment on that, or Larry or Jamie from your organizations, whether or not the audit committees have, you know, to necessarily speak about your organizations, but any perception on this in terms of audit committees looking for written reports or not, or whether they're perfectly happy getting the fact that an oral commentary and discussion of the issues, and the fact that the auditor says they don't have any material modifications orally, that seems to be satisfactory.
Marty, that's at least my perception, is that the value that the audit committee gets is from the verbal communication, the clearance, and the discussion of the issues. And obviously, the only thing that's really embedded in the report is the clearance, because it doesn't discuss any of the issues that might have been raised, so that they're going to want to hear more. So I think the report itself is really more, if you want to refer to the report, then obviously you need it to, because I think once you refer to it in a 10Q, you would have to include it. So I think just years ago, a number of companies decided to stop referring to the report to, so that they could not go through that formal issuance, because it's going to go into a drawer someplace and really doesn't have to get published anyplace.
So, Jamie, thanks.
I would just echo Larry's comments.
Right. So, the discussions are substantive and robust, and that seems to be the more important thing to the committee then, rather than a formal written report. Thanks for those comments.
Okay, let's move along to our last topic for discussion on this issue today. In light of the Audit Committee's responsibility for appointing, retaining, and overseeing the independent auditor, the board may consider adding communication requirements for auditors to discuss information on the firm and engagement leadership. Prior to the appointment of the auditor, audit committees often require auditors as part of the proposal process to provide information about the firm and the firm's internal quality control systems. In addition, for issuers on the New York Stock Exchange, the exchange requires audit committees to at least annually, among other things, obtain and review a report by the independent auditor describing the firm's internal quality control procedures. The ISA on communication with those charged with governance requires auditors to communicate the related safeguards that have been applied to eliminate identified threats to independence. The board could consider including requirements to include engagement level and firm level efforts to assure compliance with SEC and PCAOB auditor independence rules and principles, significant litigation against the firm or disciplinary actions against the firm or the engagement partner, and the reasons for changes, if any, in engagement leadership. So the next question is, should the board consider requiring the auditor to provide information about the firm and engagement leadership that would assist the audit committee in overseeing the auditor? If so, what type of information would be beneficial to audit committees? Galen Hansen?
I think this is a good question. I think the things that are in the briefing paper are appropriate. I also believe that an update on inspection status, I think that's come out and been discussed during a meeting already, and where that stands and the cycle that the firm is in with that, and also the quality control standards that the firm has adopted would be the types of things that I would expect to see here, and sort of a status update on what the firm is doing. And here again, who from the firm is being assigned, and sort of an annual update with the audit committee on who's doing what and any changes that have taken place.
Galen, is the discussion on inspection status really a function of the particular audit committee, the extent to which one audit committee is interested in inspection status versus another?
I'm not sure that I understand your question, Marty. You mean it would only relate to the particular engagement, an inspection comment, or no, or what?
No, the comment was inspection status discussed at all engagements, or is it a discussion really driven by the level of firm-wide inspection status?
I would look at
it. It's a function of the audit committee's desire to get more information about that.
Yeah, I would look at it as being all engagements, just a summary of where they stand. Where have they been inspected that year? What's their status with respect to the response? Have they remediated? Are there any outstanding issues with the PCOB?
Thank you.
Thank you for your input on this issue.
Arnold Schilder.
Yeah, may I just come back on an earlier discussion, a point that Liz again here raised when we were discussing the first questions, because we are struggling with the fact how can you address the audit committees, whereas it's not, of course, in our mandate. So also the IAASB has been wrestling with that. And there's one quote in the application material of ISA 260 that is in the line, I think, that Liz suggested. Let me just read it out. It's application material, paragraph A43. As noted in paragraph 4, effective two-way communications assists both the auditor and those charged with governance. Further, ISA 315, which is the risk assessment standard, identifies participation by those charged with governance, including their interaction with internal audit, if any, and external auditors, as an element of the entity's control environment. Inadequate two-way communication may indicate an unsatisfactory control environment and influence the auditor's assessment of the risk of material misstatements. There's also a risk the auditor may not have obtained sufficient appropriate audit evidence to form an opinion on the financial statements. So I think that at least might be a bit helpful, and if you are reviewing the risk assessment exposure drafts, Marty, maybe this is something that can be of some help somewhere.
It will be. Good. Thank you very much. All right, I think as... I'm sorry, was there another comment?
Yeah, I would make one additional comment to the three bullets in the discussion paper, which is in addition to the firm-wide discussion of the PCAOB inspection results, I think it would be highly relevant for the audit committee to understand if the company's engagement had been selected, and if so, what were the results of that inspection and any related comments or remedial audit procedures that were required.
Good. Thank you. All right. Well, thanks for all of the input on the subject of communications with audit committees. I think we heard a lot of commentary that to a large extent the communications are working well in many places. In a number of areas we heard primarily around, I think, qualitative disclosure. Auditors' assessments of the quality of the disclosures was maybe one area that seemed to have a strong consensus that that could be pursued as further addition to the auditing standard, but heard a lot of comments that basically indicated that they thought the communication process was working pretty well. Whether it was because of the standard or because it was just working well, that seemed to be a pretty strong theme. The next subject, and the final one, as we're coming down the home stretch, deals with related parties and our standard-setting project in that area. And Brian Degano, Associate Chief Auditor, will lead that discussion. Brian?
Thanks, Marty. As Marty said, the purpose of our discussion today is to obtain some feedback that will help to inform our standard-setting project on related parties. And there are several topics that we'd like to discuss today. They've all been introduced in the briefing paper. The SAG previously discussed the topic of related parties at its September 2004 and June 2007 meetings. And at those meetings, SAG members were supportive of the need to improve the existing direction for related parties. The current standard was last updated in 1983. Since then, financial relationships with related parties were a contributing factor in several corporate scandals that resulted in substantial shareholder losses. As well, since then, in 2006, the SEC strengthened its disclosure requirements regarding executive compensation and related persons, and the IAASB has issued a revised standard on auditing related parties. And the AICPA's Auditing Standards Board is also looking at its literature right now. Information obtained from the board's inspection reports and enforcement actions have indicated that some auditors might still not be exercising sufficient professional skepticism when evaluating financial relationships and transactions with related parties. The board is currently considering all of these developments, and we're looking for more input from the SAG to help inform our standard-setting efforts. The first discussion topic that we'd like to discuss with everybody is assessing the risk associated with related party transactions. Currently existing PCAOB standards highlight the importance of exercising professional skepticism when evaluating related party transactions. They note that auditors should be aware of the possibility that transactions with related parties may have been motivated by conditions such as an urgent desire for a continued favorable earnings record in the hope of supporting the price of the company's stock. Those conditions are similar to the examples of fraud risk factors contained in the existing direction on the consideration of fraud. That fraud guidance also includes examples of fraud risk factors that are relevant to related parties, and that can assist the auditor in identifying the risk of material misstatement due to fraud, that is, a fraud risk. The staff wants to explore with the SAG how a standard could better improve the application of professional skepticism by auditors. The staff is currently considering making a recommendation that a proposed standard could include a requirement that auditors presume, under certain conditions, that some related party transactions are fraud risks. And this will bring us to our first series of questions. And I'm going to introduce these two questions together in the interest of time. The first question is, should a proposed standard require that the auditor presume that the following are fraud risks? A significant related party transaction that is outside the ordinary course of business, a significant transaction with a company that is a related party that is not audited, the creation of a VIE in which the company's economic interest is disproportionately greater than the company's stated power, the existence of a dominant influence being exerted by a related party. And the follow-up question, question number two, is really a build-on question to that, which is, are there other relationships or related party transactions or conditions that should ordinarily be presumed to be a fraud risk? And in general, what we're really seeking here is feedback on how could a proposed standard indicate to auditors that there should be special attention associated with related party relationships and transactions, and therefore improve the application of professional skepticism by auditors. And with that, I'll open it up to the SAG for discussion.
Arnold Schilder.
Well, in the interest of time, we had yesterday afternoon and this morning, I thought, a very constructive discussion on the fraud risk connotation in another context. I feel exactly the same feelings, that I fully understand why there can be very significant risks here, and I also would fully agree that special attention need to be paid to that, so raising the antenna, etc. But for all the reasons mentioned yesterday and this morning, I would not find it very helpful to label it as a fraud risk. And let me not repeat all the arguments, but yes, to state that.
Joe Carcel.
Again, this is preliminary, and so I wouldn't. We really need to wait to finish. But on a preliminary basis, the work we're doing on fraud over the last 10 years looks like there's a meaningful difference between fraud companies and no fraud companies and related party transactions. So once we finalize that, if that finding holds, I think you should consider that. That is a little bit different than the fair value discussion we had yesterday. One of the concerns I had with the fair value discussion in terms of labeling it fraud risk is that at least so far, now things may be different in the future given the direction of accounting standards, there haven't been a significant number of frauds where fair value was the driver of the fraud. Compare that with revenue, where that's overwhelming where it is. Related party transactions is somewhere between those two endpoints. And so you'd need to look at that. One of the things we haven't done, but we could do going forward since we'll have the data, is to try to link the nature of the related party transaction to whether that's the causative agent of the fraud. We're just comparing disclosures of related parties for fraud companies, disclosures of related parties for no fraud companies, okay? Not whether the related party transaction itself is the causative agent. So with that said, I think it's an important area. I do think the board should try to, when they're working on a standard, to tailor the standard in such a way that it's tailored to the types of parties and the types of transactions where fraud is more likely to exist. I don't think all related party transactions, in terms of who they're with and the nature of them, are created equal. And then to just label them as if they're some sort of monolith is probably not helpful and may create unnecessary work with no real benefit.
Paul Sobel.
Well, it can't be quite as brief as Greg Jonas, but my response is really ditto. Again, I think we covered it very effectively yesterday afternoon and this morning, and I believe those reasons apply. I think the information that Joe's talking about will be interesting once the research is completed, but I still believe all of the very valid reasons that were discussed this morning for not presuming it's a fraud risk apply here as well.
Just to follow up on that, Paul and Arnold and Joe, would you consider it a significant risk?
Yeah.
General agreement then on that? Bob Daisy.
Ditto the same as well. I wanted to follow on with that. I'm not sure I'd call it automatically a significant risk because not every single related party transaction necessarily rises to that level. So I think there should be some auditor judgment exercised. But I do think at the same time for related party transactions, there ought to be an assessment of whether it's a significant risk and whether there are fraud risk factors present. So I think some positive requirements to make that determination would be appropriate, but I would be concerned about automatic or presumptive placement as a fraud risk or significant risk.
Thanks, Bob. Let's go to Doug Anderson.
I guess I'll be the contrarian on part of this. I thought about the discussion we had yesterday afternoon and this morning and in this one, and I guess I'm more likely to think that the issues you're going to have with related party transactions are more likely to be fraud risks and not just significant risks. And one of the things I was going to take issue with is outside the ordinary course of business. I don't know if I would limit it to that. I mean, you could have a transaction that's kind of an ordinary transaction, if you will, but because it's with a related party, it's actually a fraudulent transaction. You have much more risk of that. And I do agree with the comments that not everything with related parties is a risk. Right? You could have some real simple things that are not a risk. You do have to understand the nature of transaction. But as I think about the kinds of transactions related parties that will be a problem, you know what? A lot of them would be very high fraud risks and not just significant risks. And so I tend to lean much more towards calling these more likely to be fraud risks than just significant risks, because that's really what as I think about what they would be, that's what I think they're going to often turn up looking like. And that's what you're going to be worried about, intentional desire by management to misstate and using a vehicle of a related party transaction that doesn't get the kind of scrutiny or have the independence you would with other parties. That's kind of what a fraud is. You know, that's the components of it, and related party transactions seem to lend themselves to that. So I more look at the nature of the transaction to make sure it is a risk, but it's probably going to be a fraud risk.
Wayne Collins?
And looking at the first one in terms of the related party transaction outside the ordinary course of business, the ISA 315 does mention that as a significant risk, which I agree with, but not necessarily a fraud risk. It doesn't say that, but not necessarily a fraud risk, which I think is a decision you come to based on an iterative process, based on evidence gathering, and in terms of your risk of material misstatement. And if enough evidence is brought to bear that indicates suspicion as to a fraud risk, that's the conclusion the auditor would come to at that time.
Thank you, Wayne. Greg Jonas?
Well, personal confession that'll betray my bias here. I've been burned too many times by these damn related party transactions. And I take Joe's observation that statistics show that these kinds of transactions are often, maybe not as often as revenue recognition, but they're often tools for fraud. And also, they often can be the tip of the iceberg. The transaction itself may not be fraudulent, but it betrays a certain attitude of management often that suggests that maybe that attitude has manifested itself in other places. And you want to look hard to make sure you understand whether you're really dealing with the tip of the iceberg. So I argued yesterday, as did the majority of others, that the measurement uncertainty for fair value was not a fraud risk, shouldn't be presumed to be a fraud risk for all the reasons we've discussed. But this one I would elevate to that level. And again, personal bias based on personal experience, but these things are cancer in my view.
Ted White?
I have to say, when I first went over the material, I liked this concept. And listening to the conversation here, it's helped me focus a little bit more on what it is I like about it. And I understand that the word fraud has caused some consternation because it's a strong word in the previous conversation as well as in this context. What I like about it and what I would suggest you emphasize is the heightened level of sensitivity from these situations, and whether you call it fraud or not, doesn't really bother me as much, as long as I know that it is a red flag indicator to where you are going to direct the auditor to do some more work. And even on the fair value assumptions, I think I would say the same thing there, although I understand that it's, you know, less of a statistical fraud risk. But the heightened level of sensitivity is what interests me.
Paul Sobel?
Just to follow up on what Greg Jonas mentioned. You know, Greg, I wholeheartedly understand and agree with your assessment, although I believe that what you were talking about, which is the tip of the iceberg, would more likely come out as a part of your fraud risk assessment, which is outside of this particular standard. And I believe what we're focusing on here would be individual transactions, and I continue to believe that an individual transaction by itself should not be presumed to be a fraud risk.
And Steve Rafferty.
My reaction to reading this was initially much like Ted's, in that I thought maybe identifying this as a fraud risk would be a good idea. From this standpoint, I think there are many auditors, particularly young auditors, that look at related party transactions as primarily a disclosure issue. So once you've identified it, you disclose it, you're there. And I think it's identifying it as a fraud risk sort of focuses on go audit it as well as disclose it. And but having sat here and thought about the whole notion of fraud risk, I kind of gravitate away from that and say, no, I don't think it is presumptively a fraud risk, but it is a significant risk and one that we need to call auditors' attention to and say, go audit it as well as worrying about the disclosure issue here.
Ted White. Ted, do you still have your... Ted, okay, and Larry Salva?
So just to weigh in, you know, behind some others, seems to me that there's two issues. One is, you know, do you label it as fraud risk versus significant risk? And then the other issue is it a presumption or is it a consider? And I tend to lean towards not presuming that it's fraud, but in the first instance, for the unusual transactions or outside the ordinary course of business, to put that into the category of presume that that is a significant risk, and then all other related party transactions ought to be considered or evaluated for whether they also represent significant risks, depending on their nature and understanding, you know, their use within the entity.
Doug Anderson?
Just one other little point. On the second bullet point on this number one, I don't know whether the related party having been audited or not makes any difference. How the issuer or my company accounts for the transaction is really not correlated with whether the other side of the transaction was audited, because they could account for it right and we could account for it wrong. So I don't think that qualifier has any impact.
You want to give any color on that, Brian, as to why we decided to put that point up there at the auditing?
The concern there is sometimes you may have a related party that's not audited at all, and in those cases the auditor may need to go do procedures there, but without doing a full audit they may not be able to get all the information they need in order to fully understand the transaction, or they may not even be able to get access to the business records that they really need. That was kind of the thought process, that it happens in some situations.
Yeah, but I understand your point.
Yeah.
There.
Greg Jonas.
I share the staff's enthusiasm for this point. Again, part of being personally burned on these transactions was involving this as well, where with hindsight, management intended for the other entity not to be audited or audited by different auditors, so that no single auditor saw the whole picture. And that was part of the importance of structuring these transactions, and I don't know, it just warning sign wanted to go up. I put my card up, though, because I wanted to follow up on a point that Paul made to make sure, because Paul might get to the answer I'd like, but for a different and better reason. So let me just see. I think, Paul, I heard you say that look, Greg, when I'm looking at these as individual transactions, don't be talking to me about fraud. But when I put my fraud risk hat on in connection with that audit standard, I'm going to be considering these transactions together with other fraud risk indicators in designing fraud-specific procedures. If you were to do that, could you imagine a situation where if you saw these kinds of related party transactions, that you would not be targeting fraud-specific procedures at these transactions? Right. So I would be very happy with Paul's answer. His justification for that answer, he's smarter than I am, he would do it through the fraud standard, and he gets to the same answer as I would by ticking these individual transactions as having fraud risks. So if everyone were to concur with Paul's view, then I'm relaxed about asserting these transactions have fraud risks. But if others get different answers than Paul when they put their fraud risk hat on, then I'd like to label these dogs fraud risk too. A little piling on.
Damon Silvers.
I agree with this, the thrust of this initiative, and I wanted to give the staff a little bit of a legal context for it, which perhaps you're aware of, but it might be useful background for you. As a general matter, the corporate law doesn't really allow investors to challenge transactions. If they're very large, of course, there's a process for valuation and so forth. But ordinary business transactions is ordinary business. You can't go into court. Related party transactions is another thing entirely. In fact, the whole law of fiduciary duty kind of amounts to a law of related party transactions in the corporate context. That and voting is pretty much what enforceable fiduciary duties turn into. I think that embodies a recognition on the part of certainly the courts and the legislature in Delaware that this is an area of unique vulnerability where the routine instruments of corporate governance and corporate functioning are under great and unusual pressure. I think that is essentially the insight you are trying to embody here, and I think it's well. I think other people have seen that in other contexts and have acted accordingly. It's in a way it's sort of surprising that this is a matter you have to take on that hasn't been addressed before. I would also say that I think that like our discussion yesterday, there's a range of conduct here that would be troubling from the perspective of having a sound audit. It's not all exclusively acts that could be proven in retrospect to be fraud, and that the standard that you might want to do here would be one that would try to capture for the benefit of auditors the range of things they ought to be looking for. Again, I think though that the impulse here is spot on and is hardly a radical idea in view of the fact that really our whole legal structure recognizes that this is a particularly questionable area. And I would further say that, and I think this is kind of the sort of thing that Greg was alluding to, that my own experience in a whole bunch of different settings is that it is... Related party transactions are almost never what they seem to be. I mean and particularly in hindsight, they're never what they seem to be.
In light of the list up there, the four bullets, are there any other
related parties or related party transactions that we should consider, more in line with question number two. Any other items that we should consider in addition to what you saw on the previous slide, those four bullets? Galen Hansen?
I was just going to say, as I was going through these materials, it struck me that these site agreements that we see that have led to some fraudulent activities over the course of the years should come under some scrutiny, too. It seems to me that there's some elements that are connected there, and in fact they might be related party transactions that we just haven't labeled as related party transactions. So I would hope that at least that might be considered by the standard setting.
Thanks, Galen. We're going to have a further discussion in a few minutes about these other transactions, and I appreciate you bringing that up. Liz Gantner?
Yeah, my comment is along the same line as Galen. I was looking at your list and talking to Greg yesterday about it, and I said, if I can identify it as a related party and out of the ordinary course of business, I'm sort of home free. It's those that I am unable to identify as a related party transaction or maybe even outside the ordinary course of business. And, you know, it's those that are not talked about in the minutes. It's those that are not fully documented such that the evidence I need to identify them as related parties. And so if you get to what to me would be presumed to be a fraud risk, it's the ones that they have failed to even identify. And that to me is the real challenge in the related party world.
Thank you, Liz. Greg Jonas?
The one I would add here, and we're going to talk more in depth about management-related parties here in a minute, I know, but transactions with management that are asserted to be outside of management compensation, so like loan transactions or management enters into a joint venture with the company or management owns the other side of the venture or a piece of the venture, you know, something's going on here, and it's just these things are, again, my bias, but they're cancer. They betray a certain attitude of management that I think is worthy of much closer scrutiny than perhaps we give them today until after we get burned. So I would add that one to the list.
Well, this has actually been some very good input and insights for us. One thing I would just like to throw out there, the last bullet on question number one talks about the existence of a dominant influence exerted by a related party. And I know some SAG members mentioned that there may be conditions that when you couple it with a related party might elevate it to a fraud risk. And I was wondering, beyond the belief that there might be a dominant influence or domination, something like that, are there other conditions that when coupled with, let's say, a related party transaction, that one might say, you know, that might kick it up into a fraud risk category? So something that could help to inform the auditor's judgment as to what are the red flags, if you will, when you start to couple these things together, that it elevates to a fraud risk.
Wayne Collins?
Well, you'll be dealing with one of those items shortly, I think. If you've got significant short-term incentives, where the transaction in question would have a significant influence over what that compensation happens to be, that coupled could certainly elevate it to closer to a fraud risk.
Jim Schnur?
Yeah, I think you just need to be careful around this. If you think of the way this is characterized, a transaction between a parent and a sub would meet this criteria. And there's a lot of transactions that happen between the parent and the subsidiary that are kind of more in the normal course of business. So I think you have to look at who the other related party is, what the nature of the transaction is, and other circumstances before you would jump to the conclusion that these are presumed to be fraud risks.
Thanks, Jim. Let's move on to our next topic on financial relationships with management.
management is a related party, and the financial relationships that a company has with its management can result in significant incentives or pressures to commit fraud. And, for example, management might be motivated to focus on increasing the company's stock price in the short term rather than working towards achieving longer business goals when their stock options vest in the upcoming period. And additionally, if management is borrowed heavily against the shares that it's owned, it might be pressured to achieve aggressive earnings targets. Obtaining a robust understanding of the company's financial relationships with management could assist the auditor in assessing the risk of material misstatement, and it could also inform the auditor's evaluation of misstatements at the end of the audit. The staff is looking to consider whether or not to recommend to include procedures in a proposed standard that could assist the auditor in determining whether and when the auditor should obtain such a robust understanding of management compensation and financial relationships with management. A proposed standard might describe procedures that the auditor could perform to obtain that understanding of financial relationships with management and how those relationships could result in incentives and pressures for management to commit fraud. And, for example, one procedure might be to require an auditor to obtain an understanding of the company's executive compensation arrangements by reviewing contracts and arrangements and agreements. And the next question that we wanted to go through with the SAG is whether a proposed standard should include a presumption that a financial relationship with management that creates a significant incentive for achievement of short-term performance goals could be presumed to be a fraud risk, and whether there's other ways in which a proposed standard could assist auditors in obtaining an understanding of financial relationships with management, that is, management compensation. In other words, what we're getting at here is how could a proposed standard identify those instances in which the auditor should obtain a robust understanding of how management compensation has been structured and how financial relationship with management could result in incentives and pressures to commit fraud, and thereby raise the auditor's level of professional skepticism when considering those. And open it up to the SAG for discussion.
Joe Carcello?
I guess in some sense, I would think auditors are already evaluating this now, right? Because on the SAS 99, there's the fraud triangle, and one of the three legs of the triangle is incentives and pressures. And in the discussion of incentives and pressures is, as I recall, a pretty good discussion about the incentives that are created by compensation plans and tied to meeting analyst expectations and so forth. So it's not immediately obvious to me why the auditor wouldn't be doing something of this nature already. Are you suggesting that your work in inspections indicates that it's insufficient, and so you're suggesting that they do more? I'm not sure where the question really emanates from.
Well, you're right. The standards already would expect an auditor to gain an understanding and to consider it. Where sometimes you run into differences, well, I would say differences in reasonable judgment is, what does it mean when we say gain an understanding? How much work do you have to do to say gain an understanding? Reasonable people can hear that phrase and say, well, I thought this was sufficient to gain an understanding. Other people might say, well, I would have expected to do more to gain an understanding. And the thought here is, beyond just telling auditors to gain an understanding, is there other information or other guidance or direction that we could provide in a proposed standard that would help to inform them when are the circumstances such that they really need to make sure that they understand this, not a high-level understanding, but have a good, robust understanding of how these financial relationships with management could result in incentives or pressures to commit fraud. And as well, what are the types of procedures that one would expect an auditor to do to obtain that understanding that reasonable people would look at and say, that those level of procedures, when performed, will result in a sufficient enough understanding to plan and execute the audit.
Ted White.
First off, I would say that there is a wealth of information in the remuneration plans at the executive level that much of which would help the auditors do their job. I would completely agree with that. I would suggest removing the emphasis on short-term performance goals so that you don't narrow the scope. I agree that you'll find those in short-term performance measures, but I think you may find more significant drivers in long-term aspects of compensation plans, and you don't want to be stuck in the terminology of short to long. And as far as procedures, whether you want to dictate this, you know, to the degree in which they have to go into each plan, but I would suggest that in some way you frame that the auditor should have a working knowledge of the mechanics of the compensation plan, including the the formula that may underlie it, the performance drivers and the implications from an accounting standpoint. So that they know which levers and which aspects of the business actually have the largest impact on the performance plan. But again, this is a qualitative type assessment. There is no way you're going to formulate something that's highly quantitative to understand how a compensation plan actually works and drives behavior.
Damon Silvers.
Perhaps I disagree with Ted. I'm not sure. I was going to sort of give you the opposite advice, but maybe it's not really the opposite advice. I think that Ted is correct in that you don't want to write a standard such that it suggests that long-term comp can't have these effects. I think that's correct. I think perhaps the question of what do we mean by short and long-term. My view and the view of an awful lot of people who've looked at this carefully is that there's some kind of distinction around economic cycles here. If a comp package allows you to cash out in general with, and this is particular to in financial firms, but not exclusively financial firms, if you can game a slice of the business cycle, that's a short-term plan. If you're locked in over the whole length of a business cycle, that you're getting more toward the long term. And depending on the nature of your business, it depends on what the real time horizons are. Very capital-intensive businesses with 10 and 15 and 20-year plays. That's comp packages should be reflective of that, those sorts of things in some fashion. The point I would want to make that may not be in agreement with Ted is I think there is a particular risk associated with shorter term plans. It's just easier to know what you're stealing, so to speak. And this set of risks, although not conceived of in audit terms, has been the subject now of a whole lot of commentary from the President of the United States, from Secretary Geithner, Paul Volcker. More recently, the Aspen Institute put out a set of documents that the AFL-CIO is signatory to, along with Warren Buffett and Pete Peterson and a lot of other unusual compatriots, really focused on these issues. And I think that the staff, again, in this area is in exactly the right place with exactly the right set of concerns. And so I think you do want to have somewhere here an emphasis on the risks associated with particularly short-term plans. It should not, though, close off auditors to the fact that you can also play games with long-term plans and that they can be a pressure. They can be an incentive to fraud. I think what really matters is the notion that when you are looking at a transaction that where there's an executive pay structure that is. Arguably or likely to be dependent on that transaction, that is something you ought to be paying really close attention to.
Thanks, Damon. Steve Rafferty?
I think we may be focusing our attention on the easy part of the equation rather than the difficult part of the equation here. I think and I'd be interested to hear from the other auditors, but I think the easy thing is identifying the compensation arrangements. The hard part is finding the things that management might do to manipulate the financial statements to drive that compensation. I don't think this is probably the area where the standard ought to be focused. I think the assistance, if any, in improving audit quality is the other side of this.
Just to follow up on that, so I think that the idea is that having the short-term incentive could result in a fraud risk or could result in a heightened risk. and then the auditor needs to think about where that risk could manifest itself elsewhere in the financials. So, you know, what are the areas that are most likely to be subject, or if management was going to commit fraud, where would they do it, and then focus their attention there, right?
Yeah, I think auditors are probably doing a pretty reasonable job of this already, to say it a different way.
Just to follow up again, doing a good job of the first part, the second part, or both?
I think they're doing a good job of identifying the incentives that may be there. It's how management might accomplish a manipulation of the financial statements to drive that compensation that is the most challenging piece of this. But I think the auditors are generally aware of the compensation arrangements and how they work already. That would be my sense. That's not the hard part.